I think I had already commented last week how the thing that usually happens on the 12B final that upsets people is not necessarily the length or the difficulty. It's the fact for several weeks on end, we don't talk synthesis or mechanism hardly at all. And then all of a sudden, you have synthesis and mechanism and fill in the blank problems. Like you haven't had in a while. Hint, hint, hint. So if you haven't already started reviewing exams 1 and 2 for practice, you want to start there. Because it'll probably be roughly 1 quarter exam 1, 1 quarter exam 2, 1 quarter exam 3, 1 quarter Diels, Alder, and conrotary and disrotatory reactions. So the new bit of material, there'll be probably 1 question on each of those subjects on the final. Whether that means there's 6 other questions, probably maybe 1 or 2 more than that, because you know there's going to be a nomenclature question in there somewhere. Really? Really? Well, at least I'm telling you ahead of time, right? So you don't get to the final and go, "Darn, he didn't tell us we were going to have to know nomenclature." Well, you do have to know nomenclature, so there you go. And I'll cover what kinds of nomenclature, because I've got the review notes from the other day. I did grab the right notes, didn't I? I did grab the right notes. Okay. And then you will have some theoretical problems, but you're not going to necessarily have the same kind of benzene and aromaticity questions. So I'm probably not going to ask about cyclooctatetraene or cyclobutadiene. That's the question you already had. And I'm probably not going to ask you to explain ortho versus para, but maybe I already gave you the hint that I might ask something about why halogens are ortho-para even though they're deactivating, which that's a slightly different question than what you've been asked in the past, isn't it? And, of course, you haven't had nucleophilic aromatic substitution, have you? What is that? That's the one. That's that mechanism we did around the time of test 3 where you had methoxide able to displace a chlorine off a benzene ring, and it made it look like it was an SN1 or SN2 reaction, but it wasn't exactly. And so we, in fact, talked about how a benzene cannot do SN1 or SN2 reactions and what really is going on there. Is that sounding familiar?
No.
Yes. Okay. Does that sound like something that just went on your top 10 list of things to panic study? Yes. Shall we go over the quarter's worth of material? So let's get everybody's favorite out of the way. Oh, no. No more pen. I guess we can't have a final. Wow, that heartfelt thank you. Disappointment right there. That would just mean you take 2 finals next quarter, you know. It's like, wow, that's really not funny, Dr. Gray. What nomenclature did we do? Well, we had alcohols. We had a very brief discussion of alkoxides. We did review of a naming of alkenes. We learned the naming of aldehydes, ketones, and of course we have our various benzene compounds. I'm probably not going to be trying to think of the worst nomenclature problems ever, but I might try to think of some that touch on each of these different functional groups that we handled during the quarter. Leaving nomenclature, we have all the things we did at the beginning of the quarter. So, in particular, we talked about alcohols, Kevin. Mm-hmm. And we talked about several reactions of alcohols. Namely, the formation of leaving groups. So we had the reactions of tosyl chloride, thionyl chloride, and phosphorus tribromide. And remember, the difference between these, there were 2 classes. The thionyl chloride and PBr3 are kind of in the same class, because those cause inversion of configuration at whatever alcohol they react with. Tosyl chloride does not. And you might remember we did a problem where we talked about if overall we wanted to convert an alcohol to some other functional group and we did it by substitution. If you did an SN2 reaction on top of making your leaving group, then that means if you use tosyl chloride, the overall process only had one inversion, because that inversion only came from the SN2 reaction itself. But if we did it with thionyl chloride or PBr3, we had double inversion, because making the leaving group caused inversion, and then if you have an SN2 reaction, that causes inversion. So that's one of the earliest synthetic tricks or concerns that we dealt with in the quarter, stereochemistry. We had other reactions of alcohols. We had hydration and dehydration, which are reversible mechanisms. Hydration, that's to form an alcohol from an alkene by using water and acid. Dehydration, that's where you take an alcohol, heat it up, and cause water to come off to make an alkene. So the reverses of each other. We had oxidation of alcohols, which included a discussion of PCC versus chromium trioxide or water. And I'll get to it in just a moment, but that's where we first started talking about aldehydes and ketones, because we talked about making hydrates and those hydrates getting over-oxidized. And that's the difference between the PCC and the chromium mechanism, is that with chromium and water, you have the potential for over-oxidation. If you're careful about it with PCC, you don't. And, of course, at that time, we also talked about how primary and secondary alcohols both will oxidize. Primaries will make aldehydes or carboxylic acids. Secondaries can only make ketones because they can't normally oxidize past that, not to maintain the number of carbons they've got. And then tertiaries can't oxidize. Then past that, we did talk about alkoxide formation. And we talked about sodium and sodium hydride as being reagents to make alkoxides. And that was leading up to the Williamson ether synthesis. Now, this list that I'm making should not be interpreted as the 100% only topic list. In other words, if there's someone out there that wanted to ask, what about X, but then would be worried about the entire class beating them up afterwards because they somehow reminded Dr. Gray that X existed. But if X would be discovered by Dr. Gray anyways when he was writing up the final, you know. So you shouldn't be afraid to ask, but what I'm saying is if I leave something out of here, there is a whole quarter's worth, and I might forget one thing while making this list. So, but if I'm actually remembering these topics, maybe that must mean they are slightly more important in my head. But like nucleophilic substitution, did I think forget to mention that to section 3? And I may be asking something about that. So I'm just saying, if I forget it here, that doesn't automatically mean don't worry about it. Can anybody else think of anything important about alcohols that we discussed? Because I think that was about it. What's that? No? Oh, well, the pinnacle rearrangement, that kind of goes along with hydration, though, sort of. That was all mixed in there. So I think that's the last major topic. So let's go to aldehydes and ketones. And, of course, we have the reactivity of aldehydes versus ketones. And remember that even if sterics might have an effect, there's really an electronic effect as to why one functional group is more reactive than the other. Aldehydes lack one of the methyl groups that ketones have. And those methyl groups are able to provide, through hyperconjugation, electron density that helps stabilize the positive charge on the carbonyl. So
less stabilization, more reactive carbonyl, which is why aldehyde's more reactive than ketones. We had several reactions of aldehydes and ketones. Our first one was the POD mechanism, because that's where we first talked about the formation of hydrates. And of course, along with hydrates, if we use an alcohol instead of water, then that's how we got to acetals and ketals. And of course, hemiacetals and hemiketals automatically go along with that. If we throw an amine, we get enamines and imines. And of course, we had some other related random functional groups, cyanohydrins, oximes, and hydrazones. Now, for imines, enamines, oximes, hydrazones, those with nitrogen-containing reagents, remember that was a slight variation of the POD mechanism where it is acceptable for nitrogen to attack first. Now, beyond that series of reactions, we had reduction. We had sodium borohydride versus lithium aluminum hydride. We had alkylation, both in the form of Grignard reaction and the Wittig reaction. And remember, this only works for hydrazones, not imines. But we have the Wolff-Kishner reduction. Now, I can't think of any other major things we discussed with aldehydes and ketones. Oh, well, I guess I'll throw it in here now. We did discuss protecting groups. And there were only two of them that we did discuss. As far as special reagents, remember that ketals and acetals are protecting groups for ketones and aldehydes. But as far as using a reagent to make a protecting group, the only two that we talked about were DHP, dihydropyran, and tert-butyl dimethylsilyl chloride. And both of those are to protect alcohols, which you've already seen synthesis problems related to that, to protect an alcohol that may be on something that has a halogen that you'd want to make a Grignard reagent from. The only other functional group we really talked much about all was epoxides. So the formation of epoxides is a 12A topic. So the reaction mechanism of MCPBA, that's not going to be on the final. We did, as a refresher, go over that there's two ways to make epoxides. One is to just use MCPBA. So I'm talking in terms of synthesis, not mechanism. One way is MCPBA, but the other way, remember, was a two-step process where we use bromine and water followed by sodium hydride. So bromine and water, that makes a bromohydrin, a halohydrin, which is alcohol and bromine right next door to each other. Deprotonate the alcohol, and then that does an intramolecular SN2 to make a ring. What we did discuss this quarter, though, was cationic versus anionic opening of these rings. And that is pretty much the body of synthesis that we did this quarter. Past that, it's all conjugation, aromaticity, and MO theory. So starting with conjugation, since there's no secret, even for section 2, that this is on the lab quiz, because I told you it is. You're not going to have kinetics versus thermodynamics on the final at all. Yes. Because you'll already had it by the end of the day. What you will have is a molecular orbital discussion where you have to be able to describe the allyl system, something like the allyl cation, and the butadiene system, potentially at least. Of course, you already had a question related to that. Reduces your chances of getting asked the exact same question. And I'll just put to the side here that somewhere along the way you might have to do some small bit of a smog diagram. Haven't decided how or why. Discussing why aldehydes and ketones could be done using why they're different in reactivity. That could involve a smog diagram, for example. So I don't know where I'm going to sneak the smog diagram in. Could actually be when we had our discussion of cumulated dienes. You know, where we discussed where a compound like this one, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's a pentadiene. Remember that the dot is just a writing convention to show that there's a carbon there, so it doesn't get confused with just a really long or broken double bond. So that penta-2,3-diene is not conjugated, and that could be easily shown with a smog diagram hint. Of course, in conjugation, we started our discussion of what bonding, non-bonding, and anti-bonding are. You mean, should I coach you on exactly how to write the answers for the exam?
Yeah, because I thought of 12A stuff, but yes. Then when it appeared to molecular orbital, that was related to that. I didn't really know how to phrase it.
So what? Ask a more specific question.
So I know that like bonding is like you're now more stable than before if you had two separate atoms.
I think what you're getting at maybe is that test question we had where I asked what is bonding, anti-bonding, non-bonding. Mm-hmm. So bonding is when, if we're talking about these pi systems that are modeled using p orbitals, mm-hmm. bonding is when you have more favorable than unfavorable interaction between neighboring p orbitals.
More smiley
faces. More smiley faces, that's right. The world needs more smiley faces. So when smiley is bigger than frowny, then you have bonding. When frowny face is bigger than smiley face, then you have anti-bonding. And when you have a non-committal face, you know, when you have bland face, neither smiley nor frowny, then that's non-bonding because you have equal numbers of favorable and unfavorable interactions. They correspond to orbitals that are lower in energy, higher in energy, and equal in energy to completely not, unbonded systems. So there's an energy comparison. And there's the reason that the energy is different, which is due to the orbital representation. Now, if what you're really asking is, what are you going to ask so we know how to answer it, I would never ever answer a question like that. All right, that's it for conjugation. Of course, we then moved into aromaticity. Which you still haven't had yet a question. Yeah, see how I'm throwing those in there? You still haven't had yet a question where I've asked, is it aromatic? Is it anti-aromatic? Is it non-aromatic? Not what are those things, but is it?
So this is our favorite plan.
Hmm? Non-aromatic means that it is neither stabilized or destabilized by pure cyclic conjugation. So, for example, if you had this molecule, it's non-aromatic. It is cyclic, it is planar, it is partially conjugated.
but is not conjugated all the way around the circle. The whole point of aromaticity and anti-aromaticity is there's this extraordinarily pronounced, truly important drop or increase in energy that happens because the molecule's a circle. That's all the term means. So just like conjugation, when we say conjugation, there's delocalization. When I say aromaticity, that equals extreme energetic stabilization due to being cyclic and conjugated. So non-aromatic means either you're not cyclic or you're not fully conjugated. Somehow or another, there is no cyclic pi system. Because anti-aromatic has a cyclic pi system, but not a favorable one. Aromatic has a cyclic pi system, a favorable one. So non-aromatic would mean not having a cyclic pi system.
So when you determine the planar, whether it's planar or not?
That is some experience, some based on hybridization. For example, this is not a trick question. So four of those carbons are sp2 hybridized and are planar. The other two carbons are going to be effectively made planar because of the rest of the molecule. Now, since you have a single bond between the two double bonds and it's conjugated but not aromatic, it's possible that you might have some bending and twisting of that single bond. So maybe the molecule may not be permanently planar, but on average it's planar. The only times that molecules have not been planar are very specific examples I've given you. For example, cyclooctatetraene, which avoids being planar because it would be anti-aromatic if it were planar. Or the molecule that had a 10-membered ring and the two hydrogens were buttoned into each other and that caused it to distort, which is why it wasn't planar. But if I won't give you some truly bizarre molecule and expect, aha, if they built that model set of it, they would know that this hydrogen, 20 carbons away from that one over there, they're going to interfere with each other, and therefore it's not aromatic, aha. I'm not going to give you a problem like that.
So about that 10-carbon one?
Yes.
It's anti-aromatic if you were to squeeze it down. To
no, the 10-carbon one, the one that we're referring to here,
not that one.
The 8 one.
Yeah.
So, this one is non-aromatic in real life. This is what everybody got into a huge snit about before one of the quizzes or the exams, because everybody kept coming up and asking, is it anti-aromatic? And my answer was yes, if. But no one wanted to hear the if word. They wanted to hear yes or no. There's this if thing that they don't care anything about, because if requires another brain cell to then respond to the if, right? So if it's planar, it's anti-aromatic. If it's able to do what it would prefer to do energetically, it avoids being planar. But if it avoids being planar, none of the double bonds overlap, so it's non-aromatic. See how that wasn't that bad, was it? But you should have seen your old selves at the time of this quiz too. Now, having said that, if you could go back to Chem 12A and look at what they're having to do and they're on their exams, if you go back right now and look at what they're doing, be like, what are you all tripping about? You have made some progress and don't realize it because you hadn't looked backwards yet. I saw some hand. Oh, Leonardi, I know you earlier. I'm sorry. Your question.
So for a cyclic compound, they are not aromatic and non-aromatic.
They're non-aromatic. That's right. All compounds are either one of those three. Okay. Now, let me list off some other example molecules that we talked about. Oh, and I guess I should say that even though you have already been asked about the molecular orbitals of cyclobutadiene, everybody else's other favorite if molecule, because it's anti-aromatic if the bonds are all the same length, but it avoids being anti-aromatic by the bonds not all being the same length.
right? But besides knowing the MOs of that, I still have never asked you to draw the molecular orbitals of benzene, have I? Yet. Oh, there we go. This is why it's useful. This is why it's useful to show up to the review day, isn't it? That's why, because you all are here. You must have thought I'd give you something useful. And I guess I am. So maybe some of these examples of molecules that you would still need to worry about, still need to lose sleep over. See, perfect timing. Could not have done that better myself. Already put them up above here, but just so you have them all in one place to stare at. I even throw in for you all one I didn't remind the other section about. Boron and nitrogen. We didn't do that in here?
No.
We didn't do that molecule?
No.
Oh, good thing I showed this section then, didn't I? Or bad thing, you know, as far as... It's aromatic. Of course it is. Look at it. What's the hybridization of boron?
SP2,
automatically. What about the... Remember that the lone pairs, when they like to or can delocalize, they do. So what's the hybridization for each nitrogen? Also SP2. So if every position is SP2 and the lone pairs are the only electrons that delocalize, but there's six of them, then that means this molecule is cyclic, planar, conjugated, it's got the right number of electrons, it's aromatic. But no carbon involved. Yeah, that's why it's a common example. Yes?
So in the exam, if you draw something like
See, the exam is just a reflection of life, so don't ask about the exam. Just ask in real life, if...
I mean, if you know something like octa-site,
yes.
And then you ask whether it's aromatic or anti-aromatic.
Then, that's where the if word comes back in, isn't it?
So we can put if
as the entirety of your answer would not be a complete answer. If. It may be one of the most powerful words, but it ain't the only one. You need to explain yourself. To answer your question seriously, if I ask you if it's anti-aromatic, non-aromatic, or aromatic, your answer is going to depend on what you think it's going to do structurally. You'd have to say, if it was planar, it's anti-aromatic. If it's not, it's non-aromatic. There is no one answer to that question. Yes.
So if you have
cyclopropene. Yes.
It's still aromatic.
Cyclopropene is aromatic.
But it's
It's got amazing angle strain, but it exists.
What's that?
Stable is a word that means a lot of things. Borane exists, and yet it's stable, but it's not. It's reactive, but it exists. So is it stable or not?
Compared to the linear one.
Compared to the linear one, you've got ring strain, but it's still aromatic.
So more stable than the linear propene.
But it wouldn't be the cyclopropene itself. It would have to be the cyclopropenyl anion, or cation. That is aromatic.
What?
Well, look at it. It's the smallest aromatic system. Three-membered ring, only two electrons, but that fills the 4+2 rule. If you were, which I think I actually drew this one day in class, if you did the molecular, if the Frost circle, and you look, there's only one bonding orbital, and because there's only two pi electrons, there's only electrons in bonding orbitals, and that orbital would be lower in energy than a normal double bond because you have distribution of charge. So it'd be a toss-up. What's better, the aromaticity of this or the angle strain? And I'm guessing since this exists, I bet you the aromaticity trumps whatever difficulty you'd have with the angle strain. An actual productive question. I love it. Shall we move on to the last bits of topics, though? Because even though we never did finish multi-step synthesis with benzene compounds, which, yes, that does mean we'll do it next quarter. Yeah, because we can't get away without doing a little bit. And it's not like it's going to go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And, oh, my gosh, isn't it so terrible that your instructor actually wants you to remember 12B material and 12C? Oh, my goodness, how rude, right? So, but the things you do need to worry about this quarter is you do need to know nitration, sulfonation, alkylation, acylation, and halogenation. For said fill-in-the-blank or mechanism problems. And I already did the hint about chlorine, so I'm not going to do that. So the last bit of material we have, then, are our paracyclic reactions.
Are we responsible for the synthesis of paracyclic?
Oh, you mean if I gave you in the fill-in-the-blank problem that involved the Diels-Alder reaction, would I expect that you'd recognize it? Oh, really and truly? Oh, yes. There we go again, an instructor wanting you to know something. How rude. All right, so we have frontier orbital theory. We have ground versus excited states. Not as excited as after you're done with the final, I'm sure. We had the conrotatory versus disrotatory. Cyclizations. And then we, of course, had the Diels-Alder reaction, which inside that topic we did talk about pseudo-cis versus pseudo-trans. And we talked about endo and exo, as well as secondary orbital effects. And why those give you what sterically wouldn't be that favorable, the endo product, but in terms of stability, in terms of the transition state, you do get because of the secondary orbital effect. Now, other than whatever questions we might have, the words you've been waiting for. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
Is the synthesis problem involve some reactions in 12A?
You need to remember exactly the same 12A reactions as you needed to know earlier in the quarter. So since alcohols are starting groups for some of the reactions we've learned, in terms of synthesis, not mechanism, you still need to know how to make an alcohol. Which, remember, there were three main reactions we learned to make alcohols. Plain old hydration, water and acid. Oxymercuration, demercuration, so mercury acetate. And then hydroboration, oxidation, borane. So you still need to know those things because we did learn how to make alkenes, which we use to make alcohols. So you need to know how to make alcohols. As far as the other 12A reactions, no, I'm going to be focusing on 12B. Yes?
About the cyclic molecule that you talked about earlier, when there's four, let's say there's a five-carbon ring.
Okay.
So if four of them is planar.
Yes.
So
the fifth has to be.
So to what, to how many carbons that thing will not happen? About,
ooh.
Approximately.
I don't know. I'm guessing even a seven-member ring where only four of them are in double bonds.
The other three would have flexibility to move, and so it might not be planar. But then it wouldn't be even considered for aromaticity because you'd only have four of the carbons in double bonds. So for the purposes of the final, you're not going to run into the molecule where you have to worry about that. Are there any other questions? Yes. Ah, no, because that is a multi-step synthesis question. The question came up because someone did their homework, where Friedel-Crafts reactions tend not to happen if you have electron withdrawers on the ring, period. Like, even though the implication when we went over the topic is that meta-substitution can happen, sometimes a reaction just won't happen if you've got a deactivator group. And Friedel-Crafts reactions is one of the reactions that's most sensitive to that. But because I didn't talk about it in the lecture, and because that is connected with multi-step synthesis, that will be one of those things pushed to next quarter. All right, so section two. Okay, listen up, since we're getting done just a tad early, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to go ahead and unlock the door and let you all start checking out. But I guess I'll turn the recording off so that the other sections don't have to listen to all this, but... That is the end of 12B for the recording then.